Europe is in crisis. All over its member states, an insidious right-wing extremism has become the norm, most of all in Britain.
Nigel Farage, a man who's tried to dismantle the EU from within, his party could now be one of the largest national parties in this chamber.
Well, Mr. Orban, thank God there's at least one European leader prepared to stand up for his principles, his nation, his culture and his people. Thank God you're there, is all I can say. Come and join the Brexit Club. You'll love it.
The Liberal Centre, so dominant over European politics for decades, has joined in.
All potential illegal economic migrants, wherever you are from, do not come to Europe. It is all for nothing.
But amongst the despair, there are glimmers of hope.
We see that green parties all over Europe are growing, and those issues are becoming much more decisive for people because they see what is happening around them.
I'm convinced much more solidarity is needed. I also know that solidarity must come from the heart. It cannot be imposed.
So what's next for our fragmented continent? Welcome to Saving Europe from Itself, a new series from Another Europe is Possible with me, Jamie Coward, Luke Cooper from Anglia Ruskin University, and Zoe Williams from The Guardian. On this programme, we take one big radical idea from one big thinker and put it through its paces. On our first episode, we talked to one of Britain's most prolific and best-loved public intellectuals. Danny Dorling is the Halford Mackinder Professor of Geography at the University of Oxford, and his subject is equality.
When it comes to equality, Europe, of course, does not need saving from itself. Instead, it is a beacon of greatest hope in the world. Europe is home to the most equitable countries on the planet in terms of income inequality. I've just downloaded the latest OECD statistics because that's the kind of sad man I am. And the Gini coefficient of income inequality is lowest of all in OECD countries as compared to anywhere else in the world. After taxes and benefits are taken into account, and most recently, of all the whole world, it is lowest in the Slovak Republic. Next lowest in Slovenia, then the Czech Republic, then Norway, then Belgium, then Finland, Sweden, Austria, Poland, the Netherlands, France, Germany, Luxembourg, then Canada, which of course is not in Europe, then Estonia, Italy, Australia, which is not in Europe, Portugal, Greece, Spain, Israel, which is near but definitely not in Europe, Latvia, and then the United Kingdom. And then Korea, Lithuania, which is in Europe, the United States and Mexico. Pity Mexico, although by some measures its inequality rate is now improving. Denmark, Hungary, Iceland, Ireland, Russia and Switzerland have been a bit tardy calculating the transfer adjusted statistics. But safe to say, they were all more equal than the UK, apart from Russia, when last reported. Russia was only fractionally more unequal than the UK. The UK sits between Israel, which is more equal, and Russia, which is fractionally more unequal. Who knows when the next Russian statistics will be released? Perhaps the state will by then have become fractionally more equitable than the UK. We in Britain are in a very sorry state. At least within Europe, the British this year are fractionally more equal than the Lithuanians. But that's only been the case since 2014. The good news is that both that very small Baltic state and the UK as a whole, income inequalities are now slowly falling. However, they are wider now than anywhere else in Europe. And in the UK, they have been like this for a very long time. When it comes to inequality, to respecting each other, which is what income inequality is all about, we have nothing to teach the rest of Europe and everything to learn from our nearest neighbours. So how did it get to this? What else is different about the UK as compared to every other single scrap of land on the continent? The single simple answer that Sally Thomas and I were able to come up with recently when writing a book proudly, if a little ironically titled Rule Britannia, was that the UK contained the heart of the largest empire the world has ever known. far larger than all the other recent mini-empires of the continent combined. The loss of the British Empire, especially with almost all of the last colonies winning their freedoms in the 1970s, turned the colonial searchlight in on itself, and we began to feed on ourselves. This was once we could no longer exploit others overseas. It's not them, it's us that have a problem. We don't know how to cooperate anymore.
Hi, Danny.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
If the proposition is that there's something wrong with us kind of historically, and that's rooted behaviours which make us resistant to equality, how have we stayed so immune from the movement in Europe? Because you kind of notice this about Britain in relation to the rest of Europe in all kinds of things, that there seems to be a lot of cross-pollination between countries on the continent, and we're completely outside of it.
We try to ignore ideas from others because we have a tradition of thinking that we had the best ideas. When I was at school, I was taught how we invented everything.
Every
spinning jenny, it's a bit of a shock when you discover that we didn't, actually. but this is an empire thing. If you want a comparison, you can look at Russia, you know, the dead heart of the former USSR empire. And again, Russia is not a place that particularly wants to learn from the rest of that part of Europe, which part of Russia is on the edge of.
Mm-hmm.
Or Turkey, heart of the Ottoman Empire. Once you have been the bee's knees, you were it. It takes several generations to learn to be normal. It doesn't immediately happen after you lose the last overseas territory and colony. You have a residual idea, particularly amongst people at the very top, that you're special. And hence, why have you got anything to learn from those colonials? After all, they never took over a quarter of the population of the planet. You know, what on earth can they know?
I mean, it does seem, once you put it like that, it seems as though Europe would be better off without us.
Well, they're very nice people on the mainland. I suspect quite a lot of them realise that we need help. You know, it's pretty obvious. We are the kind of Texans of Europe, if you want the way of thinking about it. We're loud, brash, think we know best. But you can't have sat there for decades in Germany or France watching what's been happening in this country and not felt a little bit of pity. Also not understood it better than we've understood it ourselves. People on the mainland give us a lot of leeway, and I think that's partly because they understand that some of the most stupid things we do, in a way, are not our fault. It's just something that's working through our national psyche. We still have the same kind of schools that were brilliantly set up to train young men to be so arrogant that they could take over entire countries with just a few dozen troops. And the problem is, when you still have that kind of ethos, but you no longer have those countries to take over, what do you then do if you go to Dulwich College, you know? And also, if you don't have a city of London that's particularly buoyant, you can't necessarily go into the city and succeed. And so we have this kind of residual production of colonial officers who are now turning their kind of power inside and telling the little people in England what they should know, all claiming that they represent the little people and their best interests, because that's what we did around the world. We always had the best interests of people in India at heart. That's why we took over India.
And there's a question there about the delinquency of the British elite, because what you've described was always the case, obviously, because we're talking about imperial history. So in the 50s and 60s, Britain had this, you know, deeply colonial, quite self-entitled elite. I don't know if you agree with this or whether this is true, but there was a sense that the country knew what it was doing and it was well managed. Fast forward to 2019, and we have this elite that is completely, it seems, in this mad paranoia about the rest of the world, and has a complete misunderstanding of what that world looks like and its potential outside the European Union or all of these kinds of things.
It's as if the capable people amongst the elite decided not to go into politics back in the 80s and 90s. Sally Tomlinson in particular, who I work with, she's looked at the textbooks that were used in, for instance, Boris Johnson's prep school. And they contain the words watermelon, smiles and piccaninnies and so on.
Oh, really? Do you think it's... Because you always think that, listening to him, that his education topped out at the age of about 12 and you're getting a lot of rehashed...
Yeah, I think he probably found it quite hard at school, so he really concentrated. And so he memorised all that Latin and all of that. You know, because here in Oxford, of course, he got the 2-1 and, you know, Dave Cameron sailed through with a first. So he wasn't ever at the very top of things. One of the really fascinating things about the people currently at the top of power is the older of them, now that Theresa's gone, were teenagers in Oxford in the 1980s, in 84, 5, 6, 87, 88. And as teenagers, they absolutely adored Margaret Thatcher. And that's a very odd set of teenagers. And they joined the union and so on and got into the party. And they weren't kind of like wider captains of industry or something. They were the strange teenagers of the 80s. And hence we were left with a kind of very small gene pool, if you like, to pick from. I mean, maybe I'm being optimistic. I think this is the end of this. I cannot believe now, well, I don't think in the future so many of our leaders will be drawn from just one university. But also, I meet very few 18, 19, 20, 21-year-olds now who say, Theresa May, she's so great, I've got to dedicate my future life to the Conservative Party. So I do think this is coming to an end. But we have ended up in a very strange situation. Out of the desperate attempt to regain the greatness of Britain, my favourite comment on this is George Osborne, who's one of the saner ones of this group. In 2015, when he was Chancellor, George Osborne pledged that if we followed his economic plan, then by 2030, Britain would be the richest, by GDP per head, larger country in the world. We would be number one. Now, why did George Osborne, who is much more able than the bulk of people who are at the top of his party, why was it so important to George that Britain aims to be number one again? You know, that's a kind of sad legacy working its way through. It was just a silly thing to say. And then after he said it in 15 years, he didn't kind of quietly backtrack. He sent Matt, his kind of underling, he's now the health secretary, I forget.
Matt Hancock,
that's it. He sent Matt Hancock to kind of argue the case, the most ridiculous case. I mean, if I didn't live here, I'd laugh. But the problem is I live here and we've got to live through this. But if you look at the declines of former empires after they'd last lost their territory, it's a similar thing that happens in other places. It has repeated before. It is excusable. But if we don't learn from this, you know, we have no excuse.
Two possible readings are either yours, which is, you know, a kind of collective lunacy, or a kind of nefarious conspiracy underneath it all, you know, a nefarious capitalist conspiracy that runs the media and
captures. I honestly don't think it's a conspiracy. In a way, it's worse than a conspiracy. Conspiracies you can find out about and they require meetings and you have to actually arrange them. It's hard work. This is a set of beliefs. And they are genuinely trying to act out their beliefs that if only people would do what they say, the pride and patriotic position of Britain would be saved again. And it's beliefs they've held for a long time. And that's what I mean about the historical context. How can you have a set of people with these beliefs? Well, we trawled through textbooks and so on that people were taught in the past, and they were told this. And of course, no other country in Europe comes anywhere near to our country in terms of segregating children, sending a small number to a set of schools where up to 6 or 7 times more is spent on their education, which if you're there, logically, you have to tell yourself, you either say my parents have made a huge mistake or I am special. It is worth the while investing more in me because I have a great mind, which will become greater. The little people need managing and I am there to manage them. There are books you could look at for conspiracy. William Rees-Mogg's last book was called Sovereign Wealth, and it was a kind of blueprint for what Jacob believes in.
Yeah.
You know, we become a treasure island, we take all the billionaires, we have the lowest tax rates, and so on. Everybody else can be a servant. But that's an open kind of conspiracy. The majority of British bankers are absolutely furious. They were set up for the rest of their lives to be in maybe a mildly declining city of London. At the top, you could no longer take 10 million a year, as the Archbishop of Canterbury said, you now have to take 5. Now, their children are having to go to Munich and Paris and Copenhagen. It's the kind of end for that. The second tier banks have already moved their CEO and their chief operating officer and the cash. They've left the back office in London because it takes 12 years to move the back office. Absolutely wasn't a conspiracy. The kind of people who are good at organising things have had the rug pulled after them. The bank have spent decades bankrolling the Conservative Party and didn't see this coming.
It's peculiar, isn't it?
It's a complete mess, which those of us in the elite, I mean, I'm absolutely elite, are kind of trying to salvage in a way where, please, can we keep hold of our holiday home as well? you know, want to do lots of things. It's terrible that people have to live on food banks and so on, but can we salvage this mess in some way where I can still spend 2 weeks in Tuscany in the summer? That's the stage we're at. Mm. And the answer is no.
I was struck by the reference to Slovakia that you made. I didn't realise it was such an equal society. Mm. It had come up on my horizon statistically over the last couple of years. For some reason, it has the highest levels of Euroscepticism in the European Union and the lowest levels of turnout. That's more of a comment.
Yeah.
And my question is more to do with social democracy in Europe, because I agree completely that the mix of the social democratic regulatory state and the market has created some of the highest living standards that human societies have ever known in Europe. But there is a breakdown of solidarity today. I mean, I was living and working in Austria for 8 months, and an Austrian friend of mine, sorry to any Austrian social democrats who are listening, he did say to me, I mean, the Party of European Socialist Manifesto in the election, I mean, it's great and everything, but we have to be very honest. I mean, the Austrian social democracy are not in favour of a pan-European social contract of the type the European socialists describe. They're in favour of the social contract in Austria for Austrians.
Yeah.
And so there is something...
And there being a gate at the border.
Mm. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, there's a hell of a lot that needs to happen in Europe. I mean, there are many, many good outcomes of Brexit. Possibly the best is that it's concentrated minds on the continent to, we really are all in it together. Leaving is impossible, so we've got to make a better job of this. So you watch numerous far-right parties stop saying that they are for leaving anymore. And you watch Germany treat Greece better than it did before. A huge amount needs to be done in Europe, but the positive way I'd look at it is if you're looking at other political blocs in the world, the only other two I can think of are China, it's a very efficient way of organising a country, and the United States, which has a probably bigger democratic deficit than Europe, given that a president can get elected with a minority at the vote and so on, and the amount of money. I mean, essentially, you don't win unless you've got cash. So, again, we're at this position of Europe is actually amazingly, given the old-fashioned views of the place and given what it did to the rest of the world, at the forefront of being progressive still. It needs to get dramatically better. It needs to work out how you ensure that rather than shadowy things like the semester having the power in Brussels, the Parliament actually has the power. It needs to make sure that things are done at a lower level when they can be done. And that lower level needs to be the federal state in Germany. It needs to be smaller areas than the whole of France, too big. Same with Italy and same with the UK. Most European countries are quite a nice size. There is a kind of optimal size for democracy where you can't hide away a separate elite and nobody knows who you are. And one problem with the UK is 63 million people is actually a little bit too big. There's loads and loads that needs to happen. Europe could have a basic income. It could give everybody €1,000 a year, at which point if you're sitting on the edge of Hungary, you might decide that you don't want to move to Berlin to be a cleaner, which is not what the people in Austria say, but they might want some of their children to have the chance to go and work in future in Romania and be where there are mountains and bears. You know, it's possible to think of a very shiny and happy future for the continent if it goes in one direction, which also requires letting people in. Otherwise, me and Zoe are going to die in our old age without good healthcare. You might be okay.
That 10 years difference.
There we go. Well, this is why
the
imperative to sort this out is huge. I mean, I'm older than you. I'm in my 50s. The imperative to sort this out for me is massive, because my 70s, probably won't make it to my early 80s, are going to be absolutely awful if not just the UK, but the actual continent doesn't work out a better deal. People complain about how bad the young have it, which is fair, but they don't think about the last year of your life and the catheter and the sheets. And I wish people would concentrate on that, because suddenly the conservative old would think, unless you have enough money to pay for really high quality personal privatised care, and also somebody to check that they're doing that once you've gone demented, you really do need a European social welfare state.
And on that happy note, what's the explanation for the generational cycle that you described? Is it to do with technology, or is it the idea that we'll just have sorted it out socially and politically for the next generations, but there's going to be a bad 20 or 30 years ahead of us.
As in, why do people have different political beliefs
by
age?
Why would younger people now be okay by the time they get to 70, 80, 90?
Because in general, we achieve things. So in general, there tends to be massive progress. We sometimes go back, but we don't tend to go back for a very long time. So the question is not, will the world in future be better? It always is. And we will talk about things that happen now, which we think of as normal, which are as shocking as people being homophobic was 30 years ago and so on. Progress tends to just happen. Of course, we may wipe ourselves out with climate change or nuclear war, but in general, progress happens. The only decision is whether the progress happens faster or slower. And if you're my age, you have a massive vested interest in wanting that progress to happen faster, because the time at which I am actually going to most need a more caring society is going to be in the last year of my life. And people don't want to think about this, and this allows them to be behave in very, very selfish ways. And if they did, it would only be good for them individually, but it would help also speed forward a Europe which was also much better for younger people to be in, that allowed them to move around more, that didn't say they had to try and make as much money as they possibly could off their fellow human beings as some form of progress, as we kind of circle down to the bottom.
What I don't understand is, if Europe is doing so well on the equality measures, and as you point out, how is it that a kind of more equal society hasn't protected them from the rise of the far right?
Okay, it has.
Has it, though?
Yes, it has, absolutely, and we haven't noticed it. Well, let's define far right. The main conservative bloc in Europe is the EPP, and I would say that they are right, but not far right. There are then a number of blocs to the right of them, which I would call far right or extreme right. In 2014, our Conservative Party left the EPP, and we'd left it earlier, but it joined one of these far-right blocs with Alternative for Deutschland. UKIP and the Brexit Party are even further to the extreme right. 2014, 52% of people in this country voted far-right. There's nowhere else on the continent like that. We sent over 40 far-right, slightly rabid MEPs to Brussels. There's one from Finland. Okay, things can rise up in Austria, but they fall down. Golden Dawn, we all got very worried about them in Greece. They've gone down. The New York Times does a brilliant graphic every year about the far right in Europe. If you take copies of that each year, you'll see that far right support falls as much, if not slightly more, than it actually rises. We just report it whenever it rises in the country that it's risen. There's a lot of work behind the extreme right. I mean, the quality of production on some of the right-wing videos in Finland that I've seen recently, the Finnish couldn't have paid for that. So there are always true conspiracies that are going on, and there certainly is a Steve Bannon, whatever. Some billionaire with cash is chucking the money in. Just look at the production quality of some of the stuff that they're producing. And you know, because you produce stuff, you know you can't do that on the cheap and as an amateur. Most Europeans are resisting that. Young in particular are resisting that. And also there's a really interesting way in which the fascists of today are not like the fascists of the 30s. They're kind of tin pot versions of them. My favourite example is there's a far-right candidate in Denmark, who I think won some votes, whose day job is actually paid to pee in public as a kind of art installation. So he actually is a piss artist. And I don't want to... Like Nigel Farage, is it... What's the brand called him? A pound shoppy, not pal. Mm. Okay, they're horrible. And when they talk, it leads to people dying and being stabbed. I'm not denying that, and racism has risen. But it is thankfully not like the 20s or 30s. It requires immense vigilance, but you can be hopeful. You just have to watch out. I'm being cautious because, you know, you can create a new party and in a matter of weeks it suddenly tops the polls in Britain. We've seen that kind of thing before in Europe in the past. But there's not marching in step. There's not saluting. When they do a march, they can only get a rag-tackle bundle of people in the rain and one bus. Some cash. It's really important for the British to realise we are the core of the European far right. We make it possible for these groups to exist in the European Parliament. Our MEPs, if they weren't there, if we actually had left, the far right groupings would have had to dissolve because we wouldn't have enough MEPs. And at the European elections, this hasn't been properly worked out yet. If you combine Conservative, UKIP and Brexit Party, because they're very shades of the same thing, They had the biggest drop in far-right voting ever in the history of Europe last Thursday. They lost 10 MEPs on 2014. That's the biggest drop ever.
What, UKIP, Brexit and Conservatives?
Combined, lost 10 MEPs in 2019 as compared to 2014. Add on to that, because 10's not enough, the Unionist, who's in one of these far-right groups in Brussels, who lost his seat, and an Alliance Party in Northern Ireland won once. That's 11. So we should be having some street parties and saying, look, which country has had the biggest drop in support for the far right in Europe? It's the UK. But no, we zoom in on Nigel and go, look at Nigel. Now, I'm being optimistic, but you know, if you can't celebrate the biggest ever, most significant drop in far right voting in the history of this country, bigger than National Front losing out in 1979, bigger than Mosley mucking up. If you can't celebrate that, it's very hard for progressives. You know, you keep on carrying on in this kind of miserable way of saying the world's terrible, we want to make it better. We've just had an enormous victory in some elections. Mm-hmm. You know, it's easy numerically to add it up and say, oh, yes.
Well, that links to the referendum, because you also spoke out from day one. I think it was the day after or the week after the referendum in challenging the idea that this was a great working class revolt. Yeah. You must feel that that's been borne out in the 3 years since.
Slowly, which just shows my complete inability to get my message over. I thought getting the article published in the British Medical Journal was the way to do it, because people would know that the BMJ checks figures. And I just saw so stupid. And things like, Lord Ashcroft, bless him, did this enormous exit poll.
Yeah.
And that shows that 59% of Leave voters were middle class. And then people go, oh, there's lots of error in exit polls. So I recently had to work. It's so big that it's between maybe as low as 58, possibly as high as 60% of Leave voters middle class. You know, they're old. Where do you think the old people in Britain live? And of course, the geography of it is not questionable. We know exactly where people voted. In a way, it's quite funny that it's taken 3 years for people to kind of get it wasn't Stoke or Middlesbrough, really, really wasn't. It was Hampshire. One other thing that happens in countries that become really, really unequal is that people's educational ability drops, including people quite high up in society, and then numeracy level. We've actually got these measured. Numeracy ability of journalists in W1A is actually quite low. I mean, I'm being
How does that work, though? I mean, what's the mechanism that makes inequality drive innumeracy?
It's so funny to hear the impact thing, because when we were talking about this show in advance, so he was like, I mean, if Britain listened to Danny Dorling, we'd be living in a completely different society. So we must get his message out there.
The Tories currently spend 36% of GDP on public services. Corbyn's manifesto, 38%. Still lower than every other European country apart from Ireland. A slightly different society. I would go with Corbyn's manifesto, but really not radical. The innumeracy, exam results become really, really important in unequal countries. Mm-hmm. So they're even more important in the US, because if you don't pass your exams, you have to clean out McDonald's. What it means is that our schools, and this has happened since the 80s or 90s, teach people how to get C's, A's, or A stars, mm-hmm. not actually how to do maths. You think you can do maths. I'm amazed how many Americans come here, talk to university and tell me they can do calculus. And then I quietly say to them, what kind of calculus can you do? And they say, well, I don't really know, but I'm told I can do calculus. But then the other thing that happens in Britain, unlike in a smaller, more equitable country, is that connections matter for getting jobs.
Right.
And you end up with very few nerds, but people who can write well, but not the sufficient number of nerds to actually point out. The majority of people who voted Leave lived in the southeast of England. The minority of the electorate lived in the southeast of England. And to understand things about turnout, there may be something else going on that night, which was that the script was written for a narrow Remain win, particularly mm-hmm. because people like me and you and the people in W1A thought that the murder of an MP was really important. There was no script, obviously, for Leave. Camera zooms in on blonde woman and two bald men in Sunderland. Mm. Bang, has an idea in their head. A majority of people who are making the decisions that night in the TV studios, their parents will live in the southeast of England. They'll be grandparents, and they will have voted Leave. So they all had the answer in their heads. Mm. But they also had an internal family problem, which is that Christmas is coming up. You've got to go back and talk to your Neanderthal parents about the fact that they voted Leave in Hampshire. And it's much easier to blame the working class of the north rather than mum and dad. I think it'd be good, when the dust has settled in another 2 or 3 years' time, to talk to people who are telling the particular story that was wrong and ask them about their own families and so on, and histories and what happened.
Because as a society, we never used to accept Nigel Farage's framing, but he does appear to have become an almost totemic figure in British politics, quite, I suppose, in the last 18 months.
The narrative of the kind of angry white working class man voting Leave is bigger than Farage. I feel like people have a kind of erotic thrill around it. You know, they love the authenticity. They love to be the person who listens most closely to the angry white working class man. They love to be, you know, whether it's Lisa Nandy or Laura Koonsberg, they love to be the person who's channeling this man most faithfully. I feel like it's gone beyond Who Framed It and Dominic Cummings and Nigel Farage and Rupert Murdoch. I feel like it's gone beyond that, and it kind of speaks to some authoritarian drive where if you can authentically channel the authentic, then you're the best.
Yeah, it's the opposite to what Reagan did. Reagan did the African welfare queen. It was the antitrope. It was this mythical woman claiming enormous numbers of benefits who was black and had lots of kids in America. So this is a positive one. This is I'm standing up for the downtrodden. And it's macho. You know, in your head, you can see how big the biceps are.
Yeah.
You know, of this particular man. And it's always a man because, of course, majority of women voted to remain. And, of course, women are more likely to actually vote because what the working class man actually did is not vote. You know, what do you think people do? So this is why it's not a conspiracy. From the point of view of the right-wingers who work for Brexit, they are fulfilling their patriotic, logical duty to do what is best for everybody, that they have learned and been taught at school and that they have discussed with each other when they're having important politics here, whatever the meetings are called, and that they've worked for their whole life. And they're not doing it for them. They're doing it for the country. And what does the country mean? The country means the downtrodden man, the white man, who would otherwise be ruined by these socialists who naively think that they're helpful and kind, but actually would have a race to the bottom. And they're too stupid to understand because, of course, eugenically, you are superior. You know, that's why your parents had lots of money, because they had slightly better genes. You've got better genes yourself. Your friends have got better genes. Occasionally, like Dominic Cummings, you write a whole thesis and publish it talking about your better genes. But you're doing it for the greater good.
Did you do that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Which just makes it much easier, so we don't have to suppose.
The Channel 4 docudrama didn't mention that, did it?
No. Because they had to get his agreement, so it says at the end he agreed.
Oh, I mean, so that's why he was such a...
Yeah, well, if Benedict Cumberbatch was going to play me, I'd agree to anything.
we can fix this for you, Dan.
Yeah. Well, that's it for those of you who are listening on the podcast platform. We've had a fantastic year, but there's much more to come. To keep the show sustainable and to make it even better, we need your help. That's why we're introducing extra time for paid-up members of Another Europe Is Possible. To join the campaign, go to anotheryeurope.org/join. In this week's extra time, we'll ask Danny what he thinks about the Labour Party's decision to expel Alistair Campbell and what advice he'd give for campaigners fighting to keep Britain in the European Union. Hope to see you there.